Welcome to Legal News and Review, recipient of the Florida Bar Award of Excellence. Legal News and Review, the only real problem solver radio program using the law, with your moderator, Philip Bell, and hosts and legal panel attorney, Gary Singer, chair of the Broward County Bar Association's Real Property Section. Gary Singer is board certified in real estate law and a syndicated columnist from the Sun Sentinel. He is an expert in his field of practice. Now, here's your moderator, Philip Bell.
On the docket for today's program, all lawyers are required to provide competent representation to their clients. And competence of confidence are legal knowledge, skill thoroughness, and preparation under Florida Rule 4-1.1. But lawyers are not required to carry malpractice insurance. Today, we're going to be addressing attorneys' malpractice, featuring Alex Diaz from the law firm of Klein, Glasser, Park, and Lowe. Alex's practice has been dedicated to the defense of lawyers in professional malpractice and other related claims in both state and federal courts, as well in Florida grievance bar matters. Also, Alex has been recognized by his peers as of 2019 Super Lawyers in the practice area of professional liability defense. But first, I'd like to introduce and welcome the legal panel for today's program. Gary Singer, good afternoon.
Hey, Phil, how you doing? How was your vacation?
It was great. You know,
I missed you.
Thank you.
The whole country missed you.
Well, yeah.
Gee, I didn't even notice he was gone.
I did not
Except
get kidnapped. That's a fallacy.
Everyone else missed you.
But it was great.
Well, they gave you back.
Great. They did.
They kidnapped you, but
That's
they gave
right.
you back. We actually made some money by taking you back.
Puerto Vallarta is where we went. It's like Boca Raton there. It's very well kept.
I was pushing Trump to finish the wall, but you got back in.
The week after, they were going to not allow people to cross the border.
I tried, man. I made every call I could make.
Yeah, I could imagine. And, of course, last but certainly not least, Eric Yankwit.
I, for one, are glad to see you back here.
I said
I might
glad
be the only one.
Back.
I'm the only one.
Not
but
the only
I am
one.
Glad.
It could be. And want to remind our listeners, on most Thursdays, they can actually watch Facebook Live. You can tune in and watch Facebook Live. Just Google Facebook Legal News and Review, and you'll see the production of most of our shows as well. Also, good afternoon to our listeners on 96.9 FM, 103.9 FM, and 740 AM. That's all WSBR stations, along with our national listeners on iHeart, TuneIn, and iRadio Now. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. And also, thank you for the emails. And this was regarding a segment that we did regarding nursing home with Mark Spector as well. So it's nice to see that people are listening.
Great.
Yeah, that is great. You know, when you tune into Facebook Live, you'll see that we're at the Kelly Ustall building that recently built a $10 million building dedicated to its firm. Now, they're dedicated to justice, and just because of the resources they have, but more importantly, their successes, the reasons why attorneys do refer them cases. If you've been severely injured by someone else's negligence, go to justiceforall.com. We're in their mock courtroom. It's pretty cool. First of all, Alex Diaz, welcome to Legal News and Review.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you for having me.
And I'm not going to say you got rusty on vacation or anything.
Well, could be.
I'm not saying
it
that.
Could be.
Specifically, Eric did. I didn't say it.
Now, Alex, first of all, you're also a partner in the firm. Is that correct?
I am, yep.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Alex, I'm going to hit you with the first top question, why we asked you to come here. What is legal malpractice?
Legal malpractice is essentially lawyer negligence.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to see it in different formats. Most of the cases that we see are going to be legal malpractice, but we have seen different claims asserted against lawyers for different things. Sometimes we'll see it in the context of defamation. We've often seen it in the form of violation of the Florida Deceptive and Unfair Trade Practices Act.
FDUPA, right. How does that happen?
Somebody sends, for example, some type of collections letter, and they say you've violated FDUPA in this manner. Or
so a fair debt violation is considered malpractice?
Well, it'll be covered by your insurance carrier.
Really?
And at that point, the carrier will provide or is obligated to provide a defense on your behalf.
I did not know that. That's kind of cool.
Yep.
What about trust funds? Does your practice cover the violation of attorneys taking liberty with their own trust funds.
Like defalcation?
Luckily, those are not the cases that we're seeing, because those cases are bad.
And yes.
and really, most of the cases that we're seeing, there's not a lot of, it's not black and white where it's, you know, you're taking money from a trust account.
I mean, that's but what are the examples?
You know, interestingly,
wait a second. You shared with me that some of these cases that your firm handles are multi-million-dollar cases.
Correct.
As well. What are some of the examples of attorney malpractice on a case that your firm would adjudicate?
You know, some of the more, I guess, the more typical examples when people think of attorney malpractice is a blown statute of limitation. I mean, obviously, that's one of the easier causes of action that a plaintiff would have. Most of the cases that we see, it's a lot of gray. It's not it's not black and white. There are instances where cases just went south for one reason or another. And in hindsight, you have a former client who says, you know what, it was my lawyer's fault and this case went south and I want to recover some funds and I'm going to go ahead and sue the lawyer. So maybe for example, in the context of a plaintiff's personal injury, you have someone saying, hey, you picked the wrong expert, or you didn't put on the right witness, you didn't put on the right documents.
Well, that strategy is not malpractice, is it?
It's not, and it shouldn't be, but that doesn't mean that those types of cases aren't filed and, you know.
Still have to defend.
Exactly.
So two questions on that. I mean, first of all, like, what is the most common cause? Is it statute of limitations that you see coming in, or is it something else?
Statistically,
bad title work?
Nah, you don't get those because we have title insurance.
Statistically speaking, real estate lawyers are at the top. Probate is fairly high, and plaintiff's personal injury, because you're dealing with clients, you know, personal injury clients that usually think that their case is worth a lot more than what it really is. So a lot of those with the benefit of hindsight say, you know what, I can't believe you only settled my case for $70,000. This was a $500,000 case and you blew it. So those
isn't that every client?
You
got to manage expectations right from the beginning. And if you don't do that, you're setting yourself up.
So it's money.
That's great advice.
These are money claims. So what are you seeing on the insurance? I know a lot of lenders sue their real estate lawyers for bad paperwork, for example.
The real estate cases are hard. One of the cases that I saw very recently was a case where our client, the attorney, was representing the lender. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that the closing agent was purporting to be a closing agent for a very established title company. Turns out that that person was using fraudulent forms. And so the claim made against the lender's attorney was, you should have seen this. You should have dug deeper into the paperwork. You should have verified this individual's background to ensure that she was, in fact, a verified and an actual closing agent for this title company, and she wasn't. So, you know, it's very easy with some of these real estate deals to see things go bad, particularly there's documentation, a lot of documentation, and things will go south, and, you know.
It's dangerous representing lenders. It's a special question and an addendum to the malpractice application. Do you represent lenders? If so, you get a whole nother stack of papers.
And there's a lot of money at risk.
Yeah, and that's a bigger problem than you think. That's actually on our fraud checklist, that issue. At my title company, because it does come up a lot. There's a lot of fake players out there. It's interesting. So the second part of my question was, and thanks for answering that, is, so, you know, a lot of people, it's very easy to sue somebody, right? We have very low cost entry to sue somebody. A lot of desperate plaintiff attorneys. How many of these cases actually turn into anything real?
That's a good question.
I try.
A lot of the cases don't have a whole lot of merit, and we've been very successful at kicking out a lot of these cases on the dispositive motion stage. Mm-hmm. However, you have to understand the financial realities of these cases. And the reality is, even if you have a great dispositive motion, it's going to cost you money to get there. And you have a lot of insurance companies and a lot of attorney clients that say, you know what, if you're taking my time and I got to go and sit for a deposition and I got to give you documents, I'd rather make revenue, so can you go ahead and get this?
Isn't that part
resolved?
Of the game from the other side? Is that they're hoping that you're a nuisance and that you'll pay to go away?
Bingo.
And that leads me actually to my third or follow up question. Really, is, you know, look, this is an attorney show. People, our listeners know, you know, a lot of attorneys. There's lots of different types of attorneys out there. There's windbags, and there's, you know, competent people who work the law and the facts, right? So
have you figured out which one he is yet?
I'm the second one, okay. Right? So.
Go ahead.
Of the plaintiffs bar in this area, because, you know, suing lawyers isn't a particularly popular practice area among attorneys. Not many people do it. Without insulting, but generally speaking, are these competent plaintiffs' attorneys that are bringing fact and law-bound cases, or are these people just throwing stuff and seeing what sticks? Generally speaking, leaving outliers out of it.
Let me give that some thought. I think that a lot of the plaintiffs' lawyers that are bringing legal malpractice claims are not specialists in legal malpractice,
So
they're not aware of some of the kinks.
Gotcha.
But a lot of them are, in fact, you know, good lawyers. They're able to at least articulate a claim and put enough up there where, you know, maybe there's a little bit of risk involved, and, you know, at that point there's...
So they're probably committing malpractice by not being...
Yeah, dabblers. Right? I'm surprised to hear you say that's dabblers, like this. Right? Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
My sister-in-law is a doctor, and she claims that doctors are the world's worst patients. She mm-hmm. wouldn't even treat one, you know? Lawyers.
What if they were dying right in front of her?
No, she referred to someone else. No, but in all seriousness, what about lawyers?
You know, what we found is typically at the inception of the relationship... Mm-hmm. Lawyers, because we tend to be alpha personalities and we want to take charge.
Really?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You're problem solvers. That's why.
Yeah. So at the beginning, lawyers tend to be they want to be involved. Our clients want to be involved in every single decision. They want us to pass every single decision by them. What we found is that over time they start to trust us and they start to kind of say, you know what, these guys know what they're doing. I'm gonna just kind of withdraw and make decisions and just tell me about it after. So that's
I find it so surprising because, you know, when you're practicing law, you tell your clients, I'm on your side, I'm with you, let me take care of it. I'm with you, I'll clue you in, but we don't have to discuss every single minutiae of the act. We have to come together and come up with, let me be your advocate.
Right, but when you have lawyer clients, you have obviously sophisticated individuals that know, you know, what we're doing. So they're going to have a lot of questions. They're going to want to discuss sometimes every little thing. And we have clients on different scales. I mean, you have obviously some that really want to be involved and some that are just like, handle it. You're messing up my, you know, hourly billing here. You know, so we have different spectrums.
Probably depends on the claim too, right? If it's a nuisance claim, oh, they got me for FIDUPTA because I foreclosed them, you know, I'm sure they're not going to care too much because it's you know, versus, hey, they caught my hand in the kitty or I misblew a statute of limitations.
Absolutely. The value of the claim is going to probably impact how they feel about it. And also, does he or she view the the case as something threatening their reputation where they want to take a personal emotional stake in the case, or do they simply view it as, look, this is the cost of doing business in South Florida, and we understand that claims are being filed left and right, and those folks tend to be a little bit more hands-off and say, just figure it out.
So,
I get it.
You know, with the malpractice as an attorney, so much of what we do is our judgment, our experience, our call on things. It's like the business judgment rule, if you will, that corporations enjoy. You know, how much of this, when you're looking back, it's always so easy to go 2020, you know, backwards, you know, Monday morning, you know, quarterback. Mm-hmm. How much of, like, do you get second-guessed versus things are just, wow, you blew a deadline or, you know, you didn't whatever? Or how much is it really like the judge or whoever looking back and going, well, they probably could have made this defense, but they didn't have to, but they, you know, like, how much, you know what I mean?
That's a hot-button topic. There is the equivalent for lawyers of the business judgment rule that you mentioned is called judgmental immunity.
Judgmental immunity,
and okay. Clearly there are...
Does my wife know about that?
I could say so many times. Okay, judgmental immunity.
Right.
Clearly there are all sorts of good faith decisions that we make, sometimes without the benefit of being able to contact or discuss it with the client. For example, things on voir dire, if you're mm-hmm. examining a witness, okay? A lot of that is your decision-making, your strategy, your own experience. And generally speaking, those things should not be actionable. But it doesn't mean that we don't have, you know, plaintiff's lawyers that will, again, with the benefit of hindsight, say, why did you, you know, not get into this particular topic with the witness? Why did you introduce this piece of evidence? Or why didn't you introduce this piece of evidence? So they will certainly try to bring those types of claims, but it generally should not be actionable.
Gotcha.
You make a complaint to the bar. That's what I think the process begins with.
the bar is good at doing their due diligence. I mean, these are complex cases, and they rule in favor that the attorney did not commit anything egregious or malpractice or what
it's
have
ethical,
you.
It's ethical, right? Ethics, not malpractice.
Yes, that's ethical. You're right. Yeah. So then they come to you, a case will come to you because there's a civil suit, correct? And it's for damages. And it's like anything else, you have to prove negligence in a lot of these cases as well. But why do most attorneys don't carry, I find, in just a small poll that I've done with attorneys, they don't carry malpractice insurance?
I think it's awfully risky for attorneys not to have malpractice insurance. I mean, the reality is that particularly if you're practicing in South Florida, being sued, having a bar grievance asserted against you, that's just the cost of doing business down here. And
right.
I don't understand why any lawyer would risk their personal assets or having to come out of pocket to pay a lawyer if you can pay an insurance company, pay a premium, and then if in the event that a claim is filed, you can report it to the carrier and they'll appoint defense counsel on your behalf, and all those bills go to the insurance carrier, not to you.
But if you have $100,000 in coverage and you use part of that or ready up with attorney's fees, explain to me about that. I found that interesting.
So unlike auto policies,
right?
Just about every single lawyer, they're called errors and omissions policies, are wasting policies, meaning legal fees bring down the amount of the policy. So if you have a $1 million policy and you spend $300,000 to defend a case,
right,
the only policy remaining to satisfy a verdict is $700,000.
Wow.
You don't get the entirety of the million. So certainly a lot of insurers at this point, they're being very careful about the cost of defense, because that, if we're limiting the cost of defense, you're potentially exposing the insured to having to come out of pocket to satisfy a judgment.
Mm. Yeah, that'd be a good lawsuit. Suing your insurance company for allowing their attorney to spend too much time going down the wrong paths and not having enough coverage left.
Don't put ideas in people's heads, okay?
Gary. There are statute limitations in most lawsuits, and nothing different when it comes to malpractice.
Yeah, sadly, it's 3 weeks. I want all our listeners to know, 3 weeks for attorney malpractice. That's
oh, my God. He said so seriously. I said, what?
I would love that. From your lips to God's ears.
3 weeks.
But back to the question. What is the statute? I mean, how long do you have to file a lawsuit?
The statute of limitations for legal malpractice cases is 2 years. But that can be a particularly complex question because, for example, if you have a trial and there's a jury verdict, and let's presume that the former client thinks that there was an error made during the course of that trial, if there's an appeal that could potentially change the outcome of the jury trial, the statute of limitations doesn't run until the conclusion of the appeal.
Okay.
So even though it's a 2-year statute of limitations, that can be told if there are proceedings associated with the, in this instance, the trial.
Now, if I had a malpractice claim that I wanted to assert against some other attorney, can I threaten them with a bar complaint at the same time?
You should not do that.
You cannot threaten someone
that's
with a bar complaint.
Right. I'm thinking that's
to procure an action.
Right.
Because that is a bar complaint.
But I imagine
that's what happens
in reality.
If you do this again, next time I will. Make a bar complaint, like a warning, but you can't say, hey, unless you fix that, I'm making a bar complaint, because that's, blackmail.
If you have a good faith reason or a good faith purpose behind threatening someone, in certain circumstances that can be appropriate, but if you make that threat, I mean, that's something that the bar is going to take some interest in, and then you're going to be calling me and saying, Alex, I got a bar grievance, what do I do?
So let me ask you about that, bar grievances, because you're saying that's a big part of your practice. So how important is it to get an attorney, even an insurance attorney or a private one, when you've had a grievance made against you?
It's huge.
Why?
Several issues. Number one, if the attorney that has received a bar complaint files a response on his or her behalf, that's now admissible evidence that the bar can use against you. If you hire an attorney to represent you in those proceedings, that's not admissible evidence. That's just lawyer talk. That's number one.
Okay, interesting.
Number two, what I found with lawyers representing themselves in bar grievances, they tend to get very defensive and very critical and very emotional. And they don't view it in a very, they can't stand back and actually look at what is being alleged and how they're going to respond to this in a very thoughtful manner. And so a lot of it tends to turn into, let me criticize the complainant, which the bar does not appreciate. So it's very, very important for you to go out and get someone who's impartial, who's not emotionally intertwined with these allegations that have been made against you.
Well, you know, collusion has been in the news because of the president, but if you see your lawyer socializing with a lawyer for your opponent, is that malpractice?
That's a good lawyer.
Not. Of course not.
Seriously, if you know the other side and you can work with them to resolve the dispute, you're doing your job.
Yeah. I think you need to be careful if you have circumstances where you have a very unsophisticated client who won't understand that.
Right.
You know, you may not want to be too buddy-buddy. And look, there are some clients that want a very aggressive attorney, want to believe that their attorney is really fighting for them and is not even chatting with the other side. But that's not, I don't think that's the way that any of us want
to
practice.
Money to burn.
But actually, there is a test, and this is how you judge, I guess, to take clients on. When is a bad job malpractice?
When that plaintiff files a complaint, at that point we got to deal with it. I mean, you
that's
know.
A good point. I know we're getting close in time, and I think this is really important for our attorney listeners. Why don't you share with us your top tips, you know, 5, 10, whatever, of how our attorney listeners can not get sued for malpractice?
The easiest one is document your file.
Okay.
Lawyers are constantly telling other people, get it in writing, get it in writing. The fact is, don't do a good enough job ourselves of putting things in writing. So we don't listen to our own advice. And I can't tell you how many cases either would never have been filed or would have been a lot more defensible had there been an email or a letter.
What about journaling, like, you know, file notes that are time-based?
I find lawyers aren't doing a whole lot of that. And
some lawyers.
Are you talking about like time entries with your billing?
Your time entries and also just journaling a file.
You know, I think that's good. The problem is how descriptive are you being?
Yeah.
Because, for example, if you're having a substantive communication with a client concerning a settlement offer that came in, if you just put conference with client concerning settlement, at that point, if a client says, hey, you didn't properly advise me, what's that billing entry going to do for you? Yes, we know there was a conversation. We don't know how sufficient that communication was. Did you explain to the client the risks of rejecting the settlement versus accepting it, et cetera?
So contemporaneous client communication, document your file, what else?
The other thing, because e-discovery is such a big deal now,
and
I'm probably scaring people with this, be careful what you put in writing. We're seeing a lot of lawyers getting into email spats with their client. That doesn't look good. Attorneys who have made comments about the judiciary in email communications, if for some reason that relationship goes south, understand all of those communications, they're no longer privileged. Yeah. So now the entire community is going to know that, you know, John Smith said, oh, hey, we got, you know, Judge Johnson on our case and he's a drunk. Okay, you don't want that going out there, so be careful. We think that email is like this impenetrable thing, and no one's ever going to see it. If a case goes south and someone sues you, all of those communications are on the table, and I guarantee you that one email that you probably shouldn't have sent, maybe you were doing it from a bar on your iPhone, that's Exhibit A. That's Exhibit A in the complaint because it's leverage.
Well, I always try to think before I talk.
One more. We want one
Go
more.
Ahead.
One more thing.
2 minutes left.
Do to protect themselves.
One more thing. Be careful if your client has already been through multiple lawyers. That's something that
clear sign.
That I'm very concerned about. And just to add, actually, the fourth thing is manage client expectations.
I think that's key.
Let clients know from the beginning what their case is worth. If you're defending a case, let the client know how much it's going to cost to defend the case. People will accept a verdict or a settlement when you've told them from the beginning, this is what's going to happen. But if you're telling, for example, if you're defending a case and you say there's no liability here. We're going to win this 10 out of 10. And then you end up having to settle for $100,000. They're going to be pissed. Whereas if you say, hey, this is a case we're probably going to get hit for $5 million, and they get hit for $5 million, they're fine. They're comfortable because they already know.
That makes sense. So I you brought up a good one with the multiple lawyers. I had heard, and I don't know if it's true, which is why I'm asking, that if your client leaves you in the middle to go to another lawyer, you're kind of off the hook for malpractice.
That is kind of sort of true.
Kind of sort of true. Yeah, so you are a lawyer. Yeah, I mean, I guess for most things you're off.
I understand, Alex, your law firm, Klein, Glasser, Park, and Lowe, the founder is like the guru when it comes to this.
And you know what? You just mentioned successor counsel and predecessor counsel, and that was actually one of Rob Klein's cases. He was the one that developed that case law in Florida, which is if successor counsel could have cured predecessor counsel's mistakes, predecessor counsel is off the hook, and the last one holding the bag is the one that's ultimately responsible. That was one of Rob's cases.
Wow. Which makes a lot of sense.
That's Frazier v. Effman.
If an attorney listener or someone else wants to get a hold of you, how would they get a hold of you to talk about this more?
Best way is email. Mm-hmm. My email address is diazaz@kgplp.com.
One more time, more slow.
And it's D-I-A-Z.
D-I-A-Z-A at K as in Kevin, G as in Gary, P as in Paul, L as in Larry, P as in Paul.com.
Does your phone number have a phone number?
305-670-3700 is our...
So thanks a lot for being on. And most importantly, thanks to our listeners for listening in. Be safe and...
Be legal!
You've been listening to the award-winning Legal News and Review, recognized by the Florida Bar's Award of Excellence. To contact the legal panel hosts and guests, go to BeLegalBuzz.com. And to reach Gary Singer, board-certified real estate and syndicated columnist, appearing in 400 media outlets, including the front page of the Money Section every Monday in the Sun Sentinel, from the law firm of Gary M. Singer, PA, call 954-851-1448 for legal news and review. Remember, be legal.